This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Right, so we're just over the Severn Bridge on the same route Derek Cooper took back in 1974. In another 80 or so miles, I'll arrive in the part of Wales he travelled to. And like Derek, I'm in search of food traditions, skills and stories. He was convinced they needed to be recorded before they disappeared altogether. And he used a television programme to share that idea with the nation.
This part of Wales, from Carmarthen to the Gower coast, has a strong community feeling, and that's what you get when your roots stretch back to mythology. It's a very Celtic place. As in Scotland, they use a lot of oatmeal. Like the Irish, they eat seaweed.
Derek's 1970s series, A Taste of Britain, has fascinated me for a decade, and I'm retracing his footsteps. I'm searching for the people, places and food he recorded in South Wales in 1974. The edition was called A Celtic Inheritance, a film that has everything. It's uplifting, it's funny, and it's also heartbreaking.
It's very, very sad that the cockles are disappearing from here, isn't it?
It is sad. It is sad. It's a sad village, not only Crofty, but Pencloud and the neighbouring villages as well.
You can sense Derek's urgency in the archive to capture the tastes and traditions that, even as he worked, were fading away.
In this farmhouse, we found the last traditional hearth in Wales. You might take a good look, and I'm afraid a last look. A few weeks after we'd filmed it, it was replaced by something more labour-saving and up-to-date.
On this journey, I've packed a laptop so I can show the film to the people Derek met, who I've managed to track down.
That's the way it used to be. Look at all the people around.
Oh, there's me. It is me.
I can't believe that.
It's all the bread.
Look amazing
the,
food.
Yeah, it is amazing food.
There's an area set aside here. And as in the rest of this series, we'll bring the stories Derek told right up to date.
My father, if I'd have said we were going to Japan to sell seaweed, he'd have been looking at me something crazy. Because I think the Severn Bridge had opened and he said, well, we can go across the bridge, we're going to go to London. And we thought we'd gone to the ends of the earth then.
And why does this matter? Well, we'll be showing the film to a new generation of food producers.
Food that's produced here is coloured by my ancestry. It's part of me.
Each edition of A Taste of Britain includes a collection of food stories, and in this film, they could all be found and tasted in one location, Swansea Market. And on the screen, we see a bustling day in 1974. Crowds move past table after table, and row upon row of food inside the covered market, from fresh vegetables to chickens, bread to traditional Welsh pancakes.
Crumpogs have been mixed and cooked and sold here in Swansea Market for as long as anyone can remember.
Oh, that's Caenwyn. Caenwyn Preston. Gosh, Caenwyn.
With me standing behind a stall inside the market is Carol Watts, a Swansea Market trader all her working life. She's captured in the film in her teens, surrounded by old friends.
That looks like Anne, but I'm sure that is Anne.
It's still a place where food is brought in on a Saturday from small holdings and farms. It's rather like the country markets you can still find in small French towns.
All the local produce was brought in. So when I came in here with my grandfather, well, in 1965, when I was 4 years of age, standing in a stool in here, my grandfather, from the Thursday, would be down there picking all the bluebells, the primroses, the swede, the cabbage, the collies. the potatoes. Then we had to boil all the beetroots, two big tables, and there'd be about 12 of us around the tables doing all the beetroot ready to come to the market and benching everything I had to come here.
So the eggs are really, as they say, hopefully in supermarkets, farm fresh, and so are the vegetables. That goes for the potatoes and carrots and that noted and natural product of the Gower Coast, cockles. A great favourite of the mining valleys, cockles have been sold in Swansea Market for generations.
I'm sure that's Maureen, but then who's that for there now?
On tables piled high, on tray after tray, are the cockles, the meat removed from the shells, and portions are poured into bag after bag by more familiar faces.
She used to serve next to my grandfather, she did on a Friday. Her and Reggie used to go out as well on the horse and cart to pick the cockles.
So the people who were selling in this market, yes, would have been also the ones cockle picking half an hour away from here?
Oh yes, they did, down in Pencrell, down in Crofty. They'd pick the cockles and they would come in then to sell on the weekends.
You're one of the cockle sellers in the market today. Yeah. How many are here now and how many do you think were there then?
There's only three businesses here now, but I was only counting in my head the other day. I think there was 20 odd cockle stalls. Because you had Maud and you had Archie Gwynn by there, you had Annie Corbin, you had the Murleys, you had Liz Williams, you had Brian Phillips, my grandfather, you had Selwyn's, you had Mary, you had Sissy, over here was Gwenny, you had Marion, you had Maureen.
One of the families Carol mentioned is still in business, and so I set off towards the villages of Penclouth and Crofty to meet them. And they too featured in Derek's film.
I've stopped on a track near a factory, and in the film there's an atmospheric scene that I've never quite understood, but I do now. Derek shows us a flat, marshy landscape, and the only movement comes from a group of horses. And now in my way, blocking my path, is a pack of wild horses just happily grazing away. It's the one thing that stayed the same, because when Derek was here in 1974, big changes were unfolding. Set the scene, where are we?
We're right on the edge of the Bury in Lettier, looking out over the marsh. We're looking at sheep, we're looking at horses, the tide's coming in, and it's one of the best days of the summer.
Brian Jones is a cockle picker and processor, as well as a gatherer of seaweed. He's describing the huge expanse in front of us and points to a lighthouse in the distance.
I think it's about 8 miles down, and that's how far this tide will come up. So that is one of the biggest tides coming in and out in the world.
The cockles arrive alive and are steamed here in Penclouth.
There's a fair bit of air in my head.
In the film, Brian is shown doing the toughest of jobs, shovelling tons of freshly picked cockles into a washer.
As I said to my father, I want an early bit to be done. And he said, look, if you were too lazy to do it, I'll do it, he said. And I think he had the shovel in his hand for 20 minutes and he said, I think we'll go look for an elevator.
It's an amazing amount of work behind one food.
Dedication. Yeah. Dedication hours. Yeah. You had nothing else to do, only do your job. And sometimes they used to say there was salt water going through our veins, not blood. We were born out that estuary.
In 1969, I started to pick cockles at the age of 15. And I went with my mother. She rocked me out of bed at like about 3 o'clock in the morning. I thought, where am I at this time? It was just still dark. And off we went with the horse and cart, caught the horse in the field and off to go. And we travelled down in the darkness, down to the sands, to the patch. It was coming daylight when we got to the patch. And I thought, what in the earth am I doing out here? But it soon came apparent that I had to pick cockles and help her get on with the daily work. And that's what it started for me.
And how far back can you trace cockle picking?
We're going back six generations.
In the 1920s, around the marshlands of Penclouth, 500 to 600 families were engaged in cockle fishing on these tidal flats. They used horses to pull their carts, and they still do. A tractor on these ancient sands would somehow seem out of place.
The horses were come down this road where we stand in here and out onto the salt marsh. But the women would have to walk in, because mainly women used to do the job. And they'd walk all the way in, either with their donkey or with their horse and cart, because they'd have such a load of cockles on, they'd have to walk. And that was fit people. And we've got some photographs here of showing people that didn't have any rubber Wellingtons on. They had just cloth on their feet and woolen things or whatever they could put protect their feet, and they would walk it all the way. And they were very, very hard people. Very hard people.
But Derek was to capture a disappearing world. Horses and carts would be replaced by tractors. And family businesses along the Welsh coast would be bought up by larger Dutch and Spanish processors. Locals would eat fewer cockles. But more significantly, the number of cockles actually in the beds were falling. A story Derek told, not on the marshes, but inside a kitchen.
Just spread them over evenly.
What's this, Rosie?
The liquor, the onion being cooked.
Ah.
In A Taste of Britain, the stories of regional cooking and traditional recipes aren't told by chefs in restaurants. Instead, Derek went inside homes and into real kitchens to meet the women, and it was mostly women who'd preserved the knowledge of generations, cooks like Rosie Matthews.
Next, just a layer of the cockles.
They look beautifully fresh ones.
They are beautiful. They couldn't be more fresh. Gathered the same day and cooked the same day.
Rosie was a cockle picker and seller, and well known in Penclouth for one dish.
Now for the cockle pie. What a sight. That's beautiful.
Is it?
And you're quite right about these cockles. They're beautifully fresh. It's very, very sad that the cockles are disappearing from here, isn't it?
It is sad. You know, the village, it seems as if we're desolate. There are no carts, nothing. Well, as in the summertime, to be a pleasure to hear the youngsters singing, coming in from the sands, being out with their loads of cockles. Happy. But not now.
Not now. They used to come in, and of course, they'd all come in like one behind each other. And they'd sing hymns and whatever. One person would start to sing, and then they'd all sing.
Alison Jones, Brian's wife. But the 1970s didn't mark the end of the beds. The cockle population would rise and fall. The real problem began a decade ago.
30 years, I'd say, we had a reasonably stable industry. And then after 2001, it has declined. And of course, what we have had to do then is look elsewhere for cockles. And we teamed up with a company in Spain who buys cockles all around the UK. So we still do have cockles, but not from the Bury Inlet.
So that's our role now, is getting the cockles from Britain to be canned in Britain and then sent to Spain. Cans isn't something we never thought we'd put cockles into, but if that's the way they want them, that's the way they can have them.
Meanwhile, the fight continues for the future of the Bury Inlet. The 40 remaining licensed cockle pickers believe pollution from industry and denser housing is to blame. The authorities strongly disagree. The Welsh Assembly member for the area, Byron Davies, wants more research to be carried out.
It's a serious issue. I mean, these people have families, they have mortgages, and they want to remain in Penclouth, and they want to remain as cockle pickers. Some months ago, on a Sunday morning, I had a cockle farmer come to my house, actually, knock on the door in tears. He'd lost his house. He now lives in a caravan park. And that's the situation. That's how dire it is.
Through the winter months, we've got nothing else to do. People have lost their houses because our cockles are out there. We've been out there today, and our cockles are actually dying in front of us.
Mm. 30 miles north of Penclouth is another story Derek captured in 1974. And I'm driving towards Carmarthen to find the River Towy, because in the film there's a scene of Derek standing on its banks talking about a special kind of fish, and a very special way it was being caught.
When it comes to fishing, they're using the same techniques here, at least, that they used 2,000 years ago. In method and shape, things haven't changed since Roman times.
Floating behind Derek were men in coracles, the ancient oval-shaped boats, just big enough for one fisherman. They'd float in pairs, a net in between, in search of suin, the sea trout. And in the film, you can make out a number on the side of one boat.
So the D1 coracle. So we're looking at the D1 here, and the same. These are the licence numbers and the Dorsey numbers, and they still fish.
This is your local history.
Yeah, it's great to see. Really, really interesting.
I'm watching the film with a chef, Scott Davies. He grew up near the Towy, and I'm in luck. He recognises one of the fishermen.
one of the guys we're looking at here now, Raymond Rees. Talking to Raymond was it was amazing because I suppose he was the bridge, really, between old and new. You know, he was the child who had to pull all the hairs off the cow's tail, you know, for his father to weave for the ropes for the nets, as I suppose his father did before him and his father before him. You know, my great-grandfather was a coracle man. My father was an angler, you know, so I'd go to bed, I'd always hear the garden gate, at 9 or 10 o'clock, slam closed, because, you know, my father would be heading off across the field to go fishing. So March the 1st, even as a child, was cherished. The first sew in of the season, the first salmon of the season was always a big thing in our house.
There's also a scene of four men filmed explaining their work. They're sat inside a small wooden boat shed. And the first to speak is Raymond Rees.
The sea trout is a coastal fish. And the flesh is not quite as red as the salmon.
Not so pink.
Unfortunately, Raymond passed away a couple of months ago. But, you know, we loved talking to him. I mean, the knowledge that guy had to pass on is, you know, was infinite. And he was a real character and a shame, you know. But I'm actually buying fish from Raymond's son, Malcolm, who's a coracle man as well.
What I'm going to do now, I'm going to go through the mud and I'm going to put the coracle into the water and gingerly get in and show you how I can manoeuvre.
I phone Malcolm and soon after I'm standing in the spot where Derek stood and watching Malcolm go down a set of steps, a coracle on his back and a paddle in his hand. It's a real skill.
Most people find the getting in and getting out the hardest bit. So you have to use your paddle as a weight bearer. And then you step out, and even with me there, I nearly slipped in, you know, so it's...
it wouldn't be that uncommon to have a trip into the river?
No, it's not, if everybody's honest.
I certainly have, anyway.
Only by lack of concentration and getting in and out, usually.
And back on the bank, we go inside the building that featured in the film.
Now, this is a shed that we have adapted to a sort of mini museum. We often have schools come down to have a look. We've got some traditional coracles, and then you have your fiberglass.
There's an incredible photo on the wall, which I can see is dated 1865. There are two women in traditional dress, yeah, and a man with a coracle on his back.
On his back, yeah, that's how we carry the coracle.
Now, that's the face looks familiar, yeah, from the film.
Yeah, that's my father. There's a photo here of myself with my great-grandfather. You know, he was born in 1878. So I remember him, and that's actually here, where we stand.
This means a lot to you, doesn't it?
Yes, I was born to do this, you know. I was my father's only son. I fished as a child, and I was involved in it, but I never really valued it until I hit, I guess, 40, and then I realised that I had to sort of take the legacy on. And
what do you think happened at age 40?
Well, I'm not sure. I think it may be your midlife period, and I knew my father wasn't going to be around forever, and I needed to absorb as much of his knowledge as I could. My father passed the baton to me. I'm doing my best to tell everybody our story. It's a piece of tradition, it's a piece of history that you can still see and sample and taste.
Some of the suin Malcolm catches, he sells to the chef, Scott Davies, who left Wales when he was 17 to work in restaurants in London and New York. But he felt a strong pull back to Wales and Carmarthenshire, and there he now smokes the fish caught on the Towy, helping to keep the tradition alive.
I think what dawned on me was really was one day we were in the kitchen. It was a Saturday afternoon. This large suin arrived, and I knew it could have only come from West Wales, because suin of that size only comes from these rivers. And you know, and everyone was busy and getting by, and I was just quite sad really that such a skill and craft had gone into it, and yet all the other chefs didn't have a clue. You know, I mean, I was 17. I was a young cook. You know, so you know, I was quite anxious and quite proud of myself that I'd known where this fish had come from. I think things have changed now. Now it's a great story to tell because they want to know about it. I think at the time, the world was in a different place food-wise.
This is an old canvas of a coracle that's had its day. and the custom is it's gone beyond repair. So what I'll do is at the start of next season, I'll set fire to it and burn it on the banks as an offering to the river gods for a good season. And that's what, you know, we've done for years.
But perhaps the most revealing story to update from 1974 belongs to another food Derek had watched fall into decline.
Nowadays, there aren't enough people prepared to pick seaweed for lava bread on a commercial scale, and so it has to be imported from as far away as Scotland and Ireland. But it's still there for the taking on the seashore, and there are a few left who, now and again, go out and collect enough for their own use.
To tell this story, Derek was back in Penclouth to watch fourth-generation lava bread maker Cliff Roberts wash, boil and mince the seaweed.
After mincing, Cliff Roberts leaves the lava bread once more overnight to set firmly in its own natural gelatin.
And in the kitchen of Rosie Matthews, following on from the cockle pie, Derek got to try the lava bread.
Well, I'm going to cook out this lava bread in the fat that the bacon has been cooked in.
I say, so it'll have the flavour of the seaweed.
And the Welsh bacon.
Welsh bacon, yeah. So how long does it cook for, Rosie?
2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
There we are.
It looks a little like spinach, doesn't it? Aha. It's a bit sticky, isn't it? A bit fishy.
Fishy?
Mmm.
It's a seaweed, you see.
Does it grow on you?
Yeah.
Yes. It's good for you, though.
Well, of course it is.
Well, I shall have some more.
Yeah. You don't like it. You tell the truth now.
No, I don't think it's to my taste. You can't like everything.
No?
No.
Back inside Swansea Market, Carol Watts is in front of her stall of lava bread and cockles. At one point earlier this year, she was convinced the seaweed was going to disappear from the market forever. Although never proven, it had been linked to a food poisoning outbreak, and so in March, people had stopped buying.
If it does dwindle out, what does Wales lose? What does this community lose?
I think it loses a lot, because Swansea, the Gower, Penclouth, it's all known for, obviously, its cockles and its lava bread. We get people from Australia, America, they make a beeline to come here, so let's hope it stays, but you can never say, can you? It would be sad to lose our cockles and lava bread. Very sad. It's been my life.
The lava bread eaters have returned, and inside the market, I sat down to taste something Derek had, but in a slightly different way.
Well, here we have the classic Welsh breakfast, which consists of some fried mushrooms, tomatoes, sausage, bacon, egg and lava bread and cockles, and also a bit of toast on the side.
Derek Cooper mm-hmm. was not a huge lava bread fan.
Right.
This is my very first experience of lava bread.
I hope you enjoy.
And I genuinely think that is delicious.
It is lovely.
I like the texture of the lava bread and the cockles. And
people do add a little bit of vinegar as well sometimes. That's quite popular. A little bit of vinegar.
That's such a lovely, warm, a mild taste of the sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it does sort work really well together, and I can't wait to put that on toast.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people like, this toast on the side to dip in as well, yeah.
Maybe it's down to the right combination, but in 1974, Derek was definitely right to have recorded this story of a changing taste of Britain.
The youngsters no longer come in singing from the sands. The cockles arrive by road from England. The lava bread has to be imported from Scotland. The coracles are down to a handful. The old bakestone has taken its place in the folk museum. The inheritance is gradually ebbing away. And that's sad.
But that's not how it ends. Derek would have been inspired by a new generation, taking renewed pride in Welsh food.
It's nice seeing people excited about food and excited about local food and local ingredients as well. And, and that's why I love what I do.
Jonathan Williams, a BBC Food and Farming Awards winner this year. His street food business celebrates Welsh ingredients, including now locally picked seaweed.
Just make little pâtés with it.
What we've been trying to do is just add it to new dishes and show all the different ways of eating it. Well, it's massive, and I think potentially it's going to be huge. I think it's just expanding more and more, just because I think it's such an underused resource.
Well, this is our new project, is it? This is
is our project of making dried seaweed.
Back in Penclouth, Brian and Alison Jones's family are also taking a fresh look at lava bread.
We can see that the people in the Far East, they like this sort of thing. And my son, when travelling, he took seaweed, our lava bread, over to Japan and thought, well, they might eat it like that. They were very interested. They thought they were the only people in the world that ate seaweed. But I don't think you can sell sand to the Arabs, as they say, but we had a go, and we ended up having their idea of eating seaweed, dried seaweed. We've had to move on from where we've gone with awesome carts and walking out the sands to pick cockles with a bucket, and now we've gone flying around the other side of the world to see if we can have somebody else's idea where we can make lava bread popular again, but in a different way.
And if you took a walk through the food hall of this year's Royal Welsh Show, at stall after stall, you'd have met a new generation of food producers, like Daniel Ap Dafydd. Many had left Wales, only to return and reclaim lost food traditions.
The landscape, the food produced in that landscape, my history and my language, that's why I came back to Wales, because I'm not the one to deny my children the right to have that in them. And that will be carried on. So that's what national pride is. And food that's produced here is coloured by my ancestry.
Okay, well, this is padalas. This is our blue cheese.
It's delicious.
Yeah, there's
a lot going on in that cheese.
Absolutely. In some regions of the country, you cannot produce that sort of that creaminess.
I'm sure Derek would have been happy for us to end this story with cheese. And another story of return and revival. Carwin Adams left Wales and lived in Uzbekistan and Ukraine before coming home. And it was seeing their food cultures that inspired him.
Everybody was really happy with basic foods and things that they had for all these years. And it made me think, well, hang on, these are sort of primal foods that they've lived on for centuries and longer. And they think, well, why have we lost, you know, what we used to produce in West Wales? Simple things, nothing too crazy, nothing too flamboyant, but simple things. Why have we lost them? And maybe they just want to go back and reproduce the lovely flavours that we had before.
Carwin Adams, one of a growing number of Welsh cheesemakers. Next week, we end this series in the West Riding of Yorkshire to revisit an edition of A Taste of Britain, Derek entitled Making the Most of It.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.